For CJLO News, I'm Donald Roberge. As of May, the Société des Alcools du Québec, or SAQ, will be increasing its prices. While wines that cost $15 or less will not be affected, wines and spirits above that price limit will be moderately raised, with greater increases applying to more expensive products. The SAQ says that the adjustment is needed in order to compensate for rising operating costs. The Provincial Crown Corporation is also in the midst of negotiating with its suppliers, so is not in a position to be specific about its new prices, though they did say that the average bottle would be raised by 0.6%, whether it be for a $20 bottle of wine or a $45 bottle of spirits. The STM has announced that work has begun at the Atwater Metro Station in order to create elevator access for the public. The city's transit corporation says that the project will see two elevators installed by December, a benefit to those with mobility issues and with luggage, as well as for the young and the elderly. Two shafts had already been built between 2019 and 2021, when the station's waterproofing membrane was being replaced. With approximately 5.9 million boardings annually, the Atwater station is the sixth busiest in the metro network. It will also be the 11th station on the Green Line to have elevator access, with the STM hoping to have all 41 stations accessible by 2030. Montreal housing committees are busy educating renters on their rights. Katie Brady has more.
Crise du logement, là, c'est pas des statistiques, c'est des vies humaines qui sont brisées.
In a press conference Tuesday, Quebec Solidaire spokesperson Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois appealed to members of the CAQ. He spoke about a family with four young children in Shawinigan facing eviction.
Je lance un appel très sérieux aux députés caquistes. Allez parler à la ministre de l'Habitation. Allez lui raconter à Mme Duranceau les histoires comme celle-là. Demandez-lui d'avoir un sursaut de lucidité, et on est dans les derniers milles de l'adoption du projet de loi, de bonifier son projet de loi pour qu'on agisse pour vrai sur la crise du logement.
Meanwhile, housing advocates are busy educating renters in Montreal about their rights. Christine Plowitsky is with Legis Action NDG, a local housing organization which has been hosting rent increase workshops at different venues around the community.
So I think the trickiest thing, or I guess the most common misconception, is that a rent increase is just like a fixed percentage that's fixed by the rental board, when actually the percentages that the rental board publishes is just the base of what a reasonable rent increase might be. And there are all sorts of other expenses that the landlord can claim on top of that base percentage. So for example, this year, if heating isn't included in the rent, you would be looking at a 4% increase, which is a very, very high increase, kind of not seen in the last 30 years, kind of high rent increase.
Plowitsky said the information about rent increases on the REGI website can be confusing, but tenants have other resources available to them, like public records and online tools from the Committee Logement.
There are some other pieces of information that are publicly available, such as municipal taxes and school taxes. So if people can do a calculation of what they should be expecting on their own, they can do that even before they receive the rent increase itself. So with having a number in mind means that you can interpret what the landlord is asking for better. Tenants always have the right to refuse their rent increase, but sometimes it's not in their best interest if when they go to court, the judge is going to increase their rent even higher than the landlord might be asking for. So that's kind of the trade-off.
Plowitsky emphasized a tenant's right to refuse or negotiate a rent increase.
And landlords really try to pressure tenants into signing things very quickly, trying to say that it's the only option. Most of the time on rent increase notices, there isn't an option that you can refuse the rent increase and stay in the apartment. They'll usually only show accept the rent increase or move out if you refuse the rent increase. But tenants should know that they always have the right to refuse the rent increase. And
the next rent increase workshop is Friday, February 16th at 2 p.m. at the Côte Saint-Luc Library. You can find information to register for the workshops at the Legis Action NDG Facebook page. In Montreal for CJLO, I'm Katie Brady.
CJLO 1690 AM podcasts on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
And welcome into the starting rotation. I'm Jacob Snyder, here again with Dylan Adams. Dylan, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. What about you, Jake?
Oh, great. Can't wait to dive into all these different sports here going on. Just watched a massive game over the weekend, but actually going to start with the NHL. Dylan and I made it out to a game. We watched the Canadiens play the Stars, and just from talking about the team, I was quite impressed by the Canadiens' play. Dallas, one of the better teams in the entire league. I don't know what you thought, but really felt like the Canadiens were arguably the better team throughout.
Yeah, I was definitely disappointed in the result because we couldn't get the win, but Dallas is first of their division. They're still third in the NHL, I believe, second in their conference, and we only lost by 1 point. And like you said, like the Habs dominated the first period. Their power play, even though they didn't score on all of them, their power play looked like completely different to like last year's power plays, you know, like they actually looked like they could compete with the big teams. But then you get to the second period and they got completely outshot. I think they had like 30 shots. Dallas had 30 shots at the end of the second period after 9 in the first period. But they just lost by 1 point. So, you know, encouraging for Habs fans. I know we don't like saying encouraging when there's a loss and all that, but we got to remember this is a rebuild and competing at the top level is very important.
I was going to say, in that first period, you guys really looked like you could play with anyone. How aggressive that offense was shooting the puck. One of our main gripes with this team has been how many shots they pass up or they hesitate on. The next game, though, the Habs just didn't have it. It seemed like they put all their energy and effort into that Dallas game because they proceeded to follow that up with a no-show on Sunday.
Yeah, 7-2 on Super Bowl Sunday was not looking very good. I know it was a back-to-back game, but they did not look good at all. Caulfield's point streak ended at 11 games. Jake Allen in nets, obviously, for the 7-2 loss. I feel like I don't even know. I'm not even going to say it's his fault at this point, because 7 goals, like, it's got to be kind of his fault, the defense as well, but it just seems like this guy's in nets every single time they get huge numbers.
I was
going to
say, though, but even the game we saw against Dallas, even when Dallas started scoring, it never really felt like it was the goalie's fault. It really felt like, wasn't it Montembeau in net?
Yeah, no, he was good.
Montembeau absolutely battled. It was more of a defensive issue. Now, I know Allen's letting in way too many goals. Again, clearly the team has held on to him too long. Now his trade value must be in the toilets. I don't imagine you'll get half of what you would have even a month ago for him at this point.
Yeah, I don't really know what they're doing with Allen. There's been rumors again, but like you said, it must, like, a 7-2 loss probably brings his trade value down, but they really got to look at the defense because, like, you got to help out your goalie, man. Montembeau had, like, I don't know, like 30, I want to say 35 saves or something.
I was going to say, in that second period alone, like you said, he had faced against Dallas again here, about 20-some-odd shots. Like, it was ridiculous. Dallas was getting the puck all the time and just attacking the net with it. I didn't understand the shift from that first to second period, and it feels like the Canadiens have done that a lot this year, where they'll come out and absolutely battle with a great team and be right in there and then fall apart.
Yeah, although I will say we did see in the first period, Dallas had a lot of missed opportunities right in front of the goalie. They would get the pass right in front of Montembeau, and then they would whiff on it. You know, so that just showed, like, the Habs got lucky there. It showed defensive lapses, but they were getting lucky. That was not the case in the second period. Tyler Seguin, I'm pretty sure he scored both his goals in the second period. And they just stopped missing their opportunities.
Now, as for the game, most recent game against Anaheim, that was a 5-0 Canadiens victory, you know, finally breaking the losing streak. And you had told me before the game, an absolute must-win for the Canadiens. A very poor Ducks team, but that said, the Canadiens came out strong and 5 goals, 3 in the second period. Any thoughts on that performance? Like, was that them correcting their mistakes or just a poor Ducks team they were going against?
Well, it's definitely a bit of both, but the youngsters on the Canadiens looked like they were in full throttle that game. Slavkovsky, 1 goal again, 2 assists. Suzuki, another 2-goal night. And then Caden Primo, with the shutout, 5-0 now, he did only have 13 saves. That just shows how terrible the Ducks actually are. But still, you know, it's like, this is why I'd rather see Primo in that. It's a young guy. He has potential. Getting a shutout is not easy in the NHL. put him in nets instead of Allen. Obviously, tonight we play the Rangers. It's going to be a little bit of a different story. They're first in their division as well.
Yeah, do we know who's in net for the Habs tonight?
I'm not sure. I'm going to say, I haven't checked it out yet. I'm going to say it's Montembeau since Primo and Allen just went back-to-back.
Okay. And thoughts on this game. How important is it for the Habs to at least have a good showing? Or are you even calling this one a must-win? Again, assuming we're aiming for playoffs here.
Yeah, well, like I was telling you before the show started, we're actually closer to a playoff spot than we are to last in the conference. So if we are aiming at playoffs, every game is definitely a must win. We just beat the Rangers like not even that long ago, like I want to say 2 weeks ago. So we can definitely beat them tonight. It is in New York. It's going to be tough, but they need to follow their hot streak up. Like they need to follow up this Anaheim game with a good performance. Even if they do lose, you know, like they got to not take like 7 goals.
I was going to say, can their defense even handle this, what's been an electric Rangers offense for a large part of the year?
Well, they did the last time they played them, so I realize it's different when it's at the Bell Center on a Saturday night.
I was going to say, in the 4-3 shootout, it's not exactly like they shut the offense down. It was more their offense got going against the Rangers here. This Artemi Panarin player, absolutely incredible stats, 31 goals, 37 assists. Definitely someone the Habs will have to focus on tonight.
Yeah, he's definitely dangerous. I don't know who's going to stop him, though. It's definitely not any of our D-men. It's going to have to be a collective effort for sure.
Excellent. Yeah, you just have to focus as much as you can on him to try and slow the team down overall. How impressed, though, have you been with Nick Suzuki? I know the team isn't necessarily where we all want it to be. You know, would prefer they're a bit higher up in the playoff chase. But it just feels like Suzuki's having a great year.
Yeah, for sure. Fresh off of the All-Star game. I thought as the beginning of the season, it took him a little longer to get into stride. But now he's really hot. He's got 51 points on the season, 19 goals. That first line for the Canadiens looks like it can compete with anybody. Like all the offense is coming from that Slefkovsky, Suzuki, Caulfield line. Like they're putting up great numbers recently. It's really like the rest of the offense that's lacking. They don't really have any help. There's injuries again. Gallagher was suspended, although he hasn't really been bringing any offense anyways. Harvey Pinal just got injured again when we went to the game on the Sunday. They don't really have a solid second line or third or fourth line. Like they're relying on one line to get all of the offense, but that line has helped Suzuki become a better player again this year. It's helping Caulfield become a better player. It's helping Slefkovsky become a better player.
I was going to say, it really feels like you guys have some pillars there. Do you feel that way about the team where 100%. There is a core here that feels very good about going in the future? This is not an aimless rebuild where you're like, I have no idea where we can even start. It really feels like Suzuki and Caulfield and maybe even Primo are that core for the team going forward. Like, are you confident that either next year or maybe the year after is when we see a big jump from the Canadiens?
Well, next year will be third year of Martin Saint-Louis behind the bench. So, I mean, I'm hopefully we got to get some results in the third year. Like, if you compare it to, like, the NFL, let's say, we had Dan Campbell in his third year, finally took that big step. You know, we need the team to produce next year. It's going to depend who's on the ice and who's healthy because we've had so many injuries. I'm just thinking about Newhook and Kirby Dach. We haven't even seen Kirby Dach this year.
I was going to say, you lost one of your better players first game of the year. You're right. It didn't even make it to second game.
When all these guys are on the ice, I legitimately think that they have a playoff team, even though they're going to be very young, but they need to get healthy. And well, like you said, like it's not a seamless rebuild. Like you can see the future is bright, especially with that first line.
Definitely. And like you were saying, they're only 8 points back or so right now as we speak in the standings with all these injuries. Imagine if even half those guys were back and playing. All of a sudden, you don't have depth issues like you do now. All of a sudden, these other good players, the Caulfields, the Suzukis, have better guys around them and can even step their game up. They have so much less pressure. It feels like every game, Caulfield's under pressure to score a goal at this point, yeah, to keep the offense, especially given how bad the defense is, to keep the team in the game. Real quick, before we end our NHL segment here, I wanted to ask about the four division leaders. So you're talking about the Canucks, the Bruins, the Rangers, and the Stars. Right now, of these four, which is the most likely to host the Stanley Cup at the end of the year?
I'm going to have to go with the Bruins. I obviously, being a Habs fan, I hate the Bruins, but if I had to put money on any of these division leaders, it would be the Bruins, because they, when they're at the top, they usually find a way to get it done. I know the Canucks are hot this year, but like I mentioned to you, I think in a previous show, I don't trust any Canadian team to lift the cup.
See, that's so funny you said the Bruins. That's immediately where my eyes went, and I almost said them. But the other thing you said is what's going to back up my answer here. I 100% think it's the year that a Canadian team does break through. It's about time. They've floundered in the playoffs however many other times where, you know, okay, is this the year they're going to do it? I really feel like this Canucks team is so well-rounded. They play so fast. They have excellent goal play. They have a lot of great goal scorers on the team. They seem to be a really succinct team. Watching them feels like just fundamentally sound team hockey. Now, as for the Bruins, like you were saying, that playoff experience is scary. They have had history of success. So maybe it does end up being them. What about the Rangers? I just feel like they choke each year. That's why I didn't say them.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. I never see them. Like, the last time they made the finals, they lost to the Kings. They had a pretty decent team, but I know that obviously it's been a while. The team's completely different, but I don't see them making it far either. Like,
and Dallas, I'm never getting over that poor start to the season. I'm sorry. Like, the first month does still count. I understand they've completely turned that around, but a team starting that poorly, the history shows that's not going to be the team hoisting the cup later in the year. I'm not quite sure what that was coming out of the gates for them. Obviously, they've been on fire since, but I don't know. Maybe teams go back to that blueprint, those early games, and come up with a way to beat them. We're just taking a quick break here, and then we're going to come back with some Super Bowl talk. Thanks for listening.
If you are looking for a good start to your nightlife, be sure to check out Amplitude on Friday nights at 8 p.m., hosted by me, GRM. Anyone from a new listener to the Avid Raver will find a great selection of electronic music varied weekly. Anything from IDM to trance and techno. Only on CJLO 1690 AM.
At Cinema Public, we offer a theatrical program made up of local films and international new releases, classics and little-known nuggets, as well as short films and family screenings. Our tickets are among the cheapest in Montreal, $10 for a regular entry or $8 for students, children, and seniors. We also offer 6-ticket movie cards for even more savings. Come see us at Casa d'Italia, just across from John Talon Metro, and visit cinemapublic.ca to discover our programming. It is Cinema Public for a lively cinema.
Welcome back to the Starting Rotation. Jacob Snyder here with Dylan Adams. So Dylan, absolutely massive, massive NFL game this past weekend. Just wanted to start off the Super Bowl talk segment with your general thoughts on the game before we dive a bit deeper into it. What did you think watching it?
First half was, I'm not going to say a snooze fest, because I kind of enjoyed for once how defensive it was, because it wasn't like nothing was happening at all. Like, the defense, we saw a couple fumbles, you know. It was exciting, but second half was amazing, and the second half is really what made the game really incredible to watch. I know that a lot of fans didn't want to see this matchup. Everybody was saying this is the matchup the fans don't want and all that, but like it was a great game in the end.
Yeah, I was going to say that first half was maybe a bit too slow for me. I really wanted a bit more offense with all those offensive weapons on San Francisco, and obviously Patrick Mahomes being great in big games. I really expected more scoring early on, and was a tiny bit disappointed there wasn't, but the second half more than made up for it, and we even made it to overtime. But Dylan, something I want to ask you about, it was pointed out to me, no holding penalties called on the Kansas City Chiefs the last three Super Bowls. How do you feel like the calls were in the game? Did you ever have a major problem with the reffing at any point?
So usually when we watch Kansas City, that's like one of the points of emphasis. We always find that the refs are in their favor. I personally didn't really see anything that was bad from the refs this time out. Like, I wasn't watching the game thinking, like, the refs are totally voting for the Chiefs. But then when I saw that stat after the game, like, it really makes you wonder, like, how is that possible? Like, how can you not have a single holding penalty in the last three Super Bowls? You think about the Bosa before the game. They asked him, like, what do you think about the Chiefs' offense? And the first thing he said was, they hold a lot. So, like, it's a known thing.
Led the NFL in holding penalties this past regular season.
Exactly. So how do you not have – there's no way they didn't hold at least one time, you know? Like, it's one of the most common penalties in the NFL.
And to not get called for it in three Super Bowls just feels weird. There's holding on every play in an NFL game. You can ask anyone. Search it online. Every NFL player will agree with this. It's just there's obviously levels to the holding. But refs always tend to at least call one or two to keep it fair and even down the road and to make the game, you know, to maybe make up for a penalty earlier that they missed or to make up for potentially a bad call later. And to see none, I couldn't believe that stat. I thought it had to be wrong. And like you were saying, they've gone up against some elite pass rushers. Like, you can't tell me Nick Bosa didn't get held once. Or any of those other, like Fred Warner coming off a blitz, or before he got hurt, Dre Greenlaw. None of these guys got held at any point. Doesn't make a ton of sense. Wanted to touch on the significant plays. I'm going to run through a couple of them, and I want you to tell me if these plays alone are what lost the game for the 49ers. I'm going to start with that first quarter McCaffrey fumble. Do you think that lost the game for the San Francisco 49ers?
Didn't lose the game because it was very, very early, but they were driving. Like, that drive seemed like they were going to get, like, at least 3 points out of it, you know? Like, they looked unstoppable, at least for the first half. Like, McCaffrey was running all over them. Fumble definitely brought the momentum back to KC, but then, you know, KC didn't do anything with it either. So, it definitely didn't lose them the game. It didn't help, because if they got a score there, then who knows what would have happened. But, things happen in football games, you know, like, you're going to make mistakes. You just got to bounce back. I don't think that was a game-ending mistake.
100% agree with you there. It was just so early, and I felt like because they had moved the ball to the opposite end of the field, it helped their defense in getting a stop right back. It's not like they fumbled on their own end, and Kansas City was able to quickly turn it into a score. That would actually come later in the third quarter. This next one I'm going to run by you, I'll tell you right now, I really feel like this did lose the game. This singular play, if you erased it, I feel like San Francisco would be champions. And that is the muff punt in the third quarter. Before the muff punt, it was still 10-6 49ers. They were about to get the ball back. After the muff punt, Kansas City took over on San Francisco's side, I think around the 20 or 25, 13-10 Chiefs. Thoughts on that one being the main play that decided the outcome?
Yeah, that was a killer, man. The special teams definitely killed killed San Francisco because the defense was playing really well, kept KC under 25 most of the game. And then it just seemed like the time of that fumble was so crucial because they scored right away. Like, you put Pat Mahomes within the 25-yard line, like, chances are he's getting a touchdown, at least a field goal, you know. Like, those are momentum-changing moments, you know, and we talk a lot about momentum in NFL games. Like, both teams are going to gain the momentum at some point. And if I saw somebody say, like, if you don't – when you have the momentum, if you don't separate yourself enough from a team like the Chiefs, then once they get the momentum back, you better hold on because they're going to come right back at you.
Wow, that's a great point, especially with two – really good teams. There will, like you say, there has to be momentum swings. Those teams will get hot at different points in the game. So yeah, you need to absolutely maximize that window when you're playing your best to score as many points as possible. And San Francisco really didn't do that in the first half. The whole first half really felt like their window. Their defense completely locked down Kansas City, and they only had 10 points. That really feels like what lost them the game. But another specific scenario I want to go over, speaking of special teams, they missed extra point in the third quarter. Big deal, little deal, no deal.
Definitely a big deal, man. This is the Super Bowl. Like, obviously it was blocked, so you got to give a shout out to the defense. But as like the offensive line during that extra point, like, you cannot let that happen in the Super Bowl where every single point matters. The proof is that the game went to overtime. They make that extra point. They're up one. You know, it's a totally different story. They probably won the game.
See, the only issue with that is I feel like later on, Casey would have gone for two on that late touchdown to tie up the game and probably make it. In a clutch situation, Patrick Mahomes doesn't seem to miss those. Yes, okay, you force him to actually do it, but I'm not sure. I don't think 1 point really mattered that much. I understand, you know, on the scoreboard, it looks like, okay, would have been 2019. I just feel like the Chiefs would have found a way to make up that extra 1 point. They played so well late in the game that they would have overcome that. The final moment, and definitely the most controversial online, I have seen so many people on both sides, the 49ers taking the ball first in OT. Do you think that lost them the game?
I don't know if that loss in the game. At first, when that decision happened, like, I didn't really have a problem with it because it's the new overtime rules. Both teams get the ball anyways. If you want to take the ball, like, especially their defense had just come off the field, so if you want to put your offense on so your defense has a little break, like, I thought it was, you know, not really that much of a problem. But then the more you analyze it, like, that decision gave the Chiefs, like, an extra down basically on every play, because now whether San Francisco scores 3 or 7, like, the Chiefs are going for it on fourth down every single time. And when you give Patrick Mahomes an extra play, like, he's gonna get the yardage. So I don't know. What did you think about that decision?
So what you just said is the reason I actually support them taking the ball. Their defense had been on the field, it felt like, the entire fourth quarter and had been terrible. You're really going to put them right back out there with a Chiefs offense that has been hot the whole fourth quarter and expect them to get a stop. I feel like the outcome that happened would have happened regardless of who took the ball first in overtime. If you gave the ball to the Chiefs first, now what you said is very valid. The Chiefs feeling like they have an extra down every time. But even without that, with how well Mahomes was playing before they even had the extra down in the second half, probably goes all the way down the field and scores anyway. To where it doesn't matter. And then you talk about Brock Purdy getting the ball back in a pressure situation. Does that really end well? He hadn't really played too well all game. Like, people saying, okay, should have let Casey have the ball. Okay, let's say that scenario happens, and even if Casey kicks 3, you're talking about Brock Purdy, a young quarterback who hadn't played super well all game.
It's pretty bad, honestly. Yo.
He missed a lot of throws. Brandon Ayuk wasn't very involved. George Kittle only had a couple catches.
Brandon Ayuk was not happy.
He seems to kind of want out of there after the game. But you know what I'm saying? He's just under so much pressure in that scenario and hadn't been playing too well. I don't think what happened in overtime changed the winner.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, you saw, like, the mic'd up moments from after the game about when the Chiefs found out that the 49ers wanted the ball first. In their minds already, it was like, this game's over. Like, we're going to be in control of whatever happens after this, you know? What did you think about the reports? And, well, you hear it in the mic'd up, like, Kyle Juszczyk saying, like, he didn't know what the rules were. Like, how? Like, I understand that even under the old rules, it would have still been the same result, but how are you in the Super Bowl? You're getting paid millions of dollars to play football, and you guys don't even have a discussion about the new overtime rules that have been so controversial with the old rules. Like, how do you not have that discussion in practice during the week? You hear from the Chiefs that they're having all sorts of discussions about possible scenarios in overtime and all that. How does Kyle Shanahan not talk about, like, did they not discuss, what, did they decide they wanted the ball in that moment? Like, I don't understand. Like, did they not have a discussion about this?
There's the key. Kyle Shanahan in big games, it's starting to become a very, very clear pattern that he can't get it done. Whatever he's doing in games or even before the games, he is not properly preparing his teams to finish. You see, he's able to get the team to come out and take these big leads. Last two Super Bowls against Kansas City, this one and the past one, 10 points. Obviously, when he was the offensive coordinator for the Falcons, 28-3 over the Patriots. Just, he's able to come up with a game plan early on that helps the offense cruise down the field and score, even though they didn't quite do that as much this game. He's able to come up with a game plan that gets his offense a significant lead, and then it absolutely falls apart. And I think that all plays into what you talk about not knowing the overtime rules. That just falls into this narrative that I'm starting to feel is true, that Kyle Shanahan is not going through the proper steps before these games to properly prepare his team to play 60 minutes. It really feels like he's preparing them to play 30, maybe even 45, but a full 60, absolutely not. Players not knowing the OT rules are inexcusable in a game like that. Like you had said, the Chiefs and Andy Reid, they talked about it multiple times throughout the week. How could you not do that as a coach? Like, do you ever remember a situation where players actively came out after the game, during the game in the mic'd up segments and said they didn't know the rules?
And especially, like, it's the Super Bowl. Like, this isn't game three in September. This is the Super Bowl. You've made it all this way. Your season's on the line. Once again, the old rules, with the old rules, the same result would have happened. But, like, maybe their decision, because Kyle Juszczyk literally said, he's like, oh, wait, like, even if we score a touchdown, they still get the ball, which means in his head, he's probably thinking, like, we should have taken the ball second. I don't know, man. It's a, like, it was a weird, and like, I just don't understand how you're getting paid millions of dollars and you don't know the freaking overtime rules, man.
No, I know. But again, some of it too has to fall on the players. Do you not care enough to look them up yourselves? Like, hey, literally, if we have overtime coming up, you know what? I should probably check this. I have 2 weeks to prepare for this game. I know it's not likely, and I believe this is only like the second overtime Super Bowl ever, maybe even the first.
Yeah, second.
And like, how do you not put it on yourself to fully prepare for all situations? All these guys talk about is the prep work they put into it. How do you not go over something basic like the rules? Another overtime coaching point you had brought up, I completely agree with here. Not a lot of blocking on Chris Jones in overtime by the 49ers.
Yeah, there was that one specific play where Brandon Ayuk was wide open in the end zone. His defender fell down, and Purdy just had 0 seconds to throw the ball because for some reason they did not block, not any defensive player, not a backup defensive player, not a random guy that, you know, casual viewers don't know. This is Chris Jones, one of the best players in the NFL, possibly the best player, some say, at his position. How are you not blocking this guy in your own in their red zone in overtime of the NFL, man? Like, absolutely unacceptable. If they block Chris Jones for even a second, you know, just get like a body on him for a second, that gives Purdy time to look and see a wide open Ayuk, throw him the ball in the touchdown, and you're up seven. Like, how do you not block the best player on their defense?
Okay, so we've pointed out a number of things now. Where do they go from here with the Kyle Shanahan situation? Obviously, he's producing such great records each year. They're making these deep playoff runs, but they fall apart. Let's say you're running the team. You're either John Lynch, the GM, or you're higher up. You're the VP of the team. Any ideas about making a change?
No, I think right now you're fresh off the loss. You're going to have a lot of ideas, emotional ideas in your mind. Maybe you're thinking about trading people, firing people. I don't think this team did make it to the Super Bowl. Let's not forget that. They were a couple plays away from winning. You got to run it back. But this is a recurring thing with Shanahan. So let's say next year they don't even get to the, even if, I don't know. I think next year got to be like, this is it for Shanahan if you don't win the Super Bowl. Like, because at what point do you fire this guy? Like, I know they're getting far, but they're not winning. And would you rather finish last and get a good draft pick or go all the way every year but lose at the end? Like, how much is that building your team?
Right, like, he's given you so much evidence. He's not going to be able to help the team finish in these situations. Before the season, that was a sneaky head coach firing for me, Kyle Shanahan. He's been there a long time and has zero titles. If I told you, just in general, someone in the NFL coached the same team for 5 years or maybe even six, has had a lot of control over personnel, runs the offense himself, and has produced zero titles, would you tell me that person still has a job? Just in general, not looking at any other factors, just a general scenario there. Would you say that person still has a job?
It'd be, I don't know. It'd be, I'd have to know their their record. You know,
but just on surface, just on the surface of that.
No.
Exactly. And everything else gets looked at with Shanahan, the deep runs. But like you said, how many are you just okay with losing each time?
What about what do you think about them firing? He fires the DC after the Super Bowl loss as if the DC, like, I don't know. What do you think about that one? Because that was kind of a, like,
oh, didn't question that feel, mark. That felt like a scapegoat. Yeah. It felt like it was going to happen. He was going to fire someone. And again, this all falls back on the Shanahan cycle. Seemed to do that every year. I think the last time he lost the Super Bowl might have been the OC that got let go or took another job or like the special teams coach or something. And it's him deflecting blame. And it's gotten to the point where I think more fingers maybe need to be pointed at him. To switch it up a little bit, where do you think this version of the Chiefs, I understand a lot of different players, but still the main core, Mahomes, Kelsey, like you say, Chris Jones, where do they rank for you among all the NFL dynasties?
Are we just talking about this year's Chiefs team or the dynasty?
No, just the whole body of work the last 5 years, 3 Super Bowls in 5 years. Well, I don't need a definitive ranking per se, but just are they up there for you with the Patriots teams, with those Cowboys teams, with those old Niners teams?
No, absolutely. Maybe not. It's kind of hard to be up there with the Patriots. They got six rings and like they basically had 2 dynasties with Tom Brady. It's kind of hard to put them up there, but they're definitely like right behind them, I would say. Like in this era of sports, we've seen how hard it is for teams to win back-to-back years or to build dynasties, and like people were telling them all year, you're not going to do it this year, and they still did it, you know? They traded Tyreek Hill. Everybody was saying last year, like, how are you going to perform on offense without Tyreek Hill? They won the Super Bowl. This year, they're like, all your players are dropping balls during the season. How are you going to perform in the playoffs? They won the Super Bowl. So, like, they are right up there in the top 5, like, dynasties of all time, in my opinion.
Yeah, one of the strangest Super Bowl champions I've seen in memory. Led the NFL in both drops and holding calls and ended up the champion. Not quite sure what that regular season was, to be honest with you. Like you said, there are so many instances of poor play. You really didn't think they'd be the ones on top at the end, and so many other teams just look so great throughout the year, especially like the Ravens and even the team they just played, the 49ers. For me, this elevates them so high in the dynasty rankings, winning in a year where they looked so poor. This wasn't the team before that just came out, the world beaters that would win 14 games, and it's like, okay, yes, they're probably going to win the Super Bowl now. They won 14 games. They look great all year. They just need to keep doing what they were doing. The Kansas City Chiefs essentially had to stop everything they were doing on offense and almost reinvent themselves in a way to start playing towards that defense. It was incredibly impressive to watch, and I just feel like going forward, that window is just going to remain open. Like, do you see any reason they'd fall off, especially after such a subpar year, ending up in a title?
Well, nobody's allowed to say they're going to fall off because every time they say it, they win a Super Bowl. I don't know how they'll perform next season based off this season, but don't let them get into the playoffs because anything can happen after that. It's got to be hard to get motivated for some regular season games after you go on title runs, you know? So I can kind of see that being in effect during the season. Like, maybe that's why you're dropping balls, lack of concentration. You're just, like, not there during the game because you're thinking about how it's, like, week 2, you know? But don't let them get into the playoffs because they can be the last seed of the wild card next year, and I'll still tell you that they might win the Super Bowl.
I was going to say, it really feels like it doesn't matter anymore. It feels like they could be any seed.
Because they got Pat Mahomes, man. We saw it in the second half especially. Like, this guy is the best player in the NFL.
He really is. His ability to make plays in tough situations where he started to get his feet involved, you know, he's not a huge runner, but the way he used it and how effective he was with it, just extremely impressed me. He was able to change it up on a dime, essentially, to where he's dropping back all the time, and then all of a sudden, okay, guys aren't open, San Francisco's really blanking them, let me make the biggest plays on third down now with my legs. Speaking of Mahomes, I'm interested in your Super Bowl MVP and also LVP, least valuable player.
So MVP, you got to agree with Mahomes. At first off, I was going to say like Jennings from the Niners, because he had not only did he have a receiving touchdown, he had a passing touchdown, and he's a receiver. he was having a great game, but then they lost, and Patrick Mahomes took over in the second half in the overtime. You just saw him, like you said, make plays with his legs, like fourth and one, season on the line in overtime of the Super Bowl. Patrick Mahomes just takes it himself, you know? Like, he won that game for them. He showed why he's making the big bucks. He showed why he's the best player in the league. Least valuable player? It's a good question. I'll let you answer that one first.
So, for me, least valuable player 100% had to be, I'm blanking on his name right now, but the punt returner for the 49ers. Not the punt returner, but one of the gunners blocking on the side that muffed the punt off his foot and put the punt returner in a bad situation. Now, the punt returner still had the opportunity to dive on it and prevent a worse situation and did not. Actually, my MVP, although, again, extremely impressed by his second half performance, but the one that really stood out to me throughout the whole game, you mentioned him a couple times, Chris Jones. I really feel like Chris Jones set the entire tone for that team. The way their defense completely locked down the 49ers whenever they really needed a stop, felt like he was in on the backfield every play, always drawing holding calls, really stifling Christian McCaffrey. Yes, McCaffrey had a couple big plays, but nowhere near 100 yards rushing. Extremely impressed by Jones throughout the game.
Yeah, I agree, man. Chris Jones, he's been a baller for a while now. He was good. I just think that, like, obviously the quarterback always gets more attention, and deservedly so this time. Like, he's the one who had the ball in his hands. Like, that's why I just think you can't go away from giving it to Mahomes.
You touched on this earlier, but how'd you feel Brock Purdy did?
I mean, I probably said he didn't play that good earlier. I'm not going to say he didn't play that good. It's his second season in the NFL when he's in the Super Bowl. He played okay. Like, but the thing is, you clearly saw the difference between an elite quarterback and Brock Purdy. I'm not saying he will never be an elite quarterback. Once again, second season Super Bowl finalist already. But he had a couple key missed throws. They didn't throw to Ayuk, who seems like he was one of the biggest reasons they got to the Super Bowl. I don't know if that's on Purdy. I don't know if that's on Shanahan. But he could have definitely played better. He said it himself. He's like, I could have played better.
Real quick, because we're starting to get up against it here. Favorite Super Bowl commercial? I know mine. I've sent you mine a few times. The Dunkin' Donuts one. Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, Tom Brady, Jennifer Lopez. Absolutely hilarious. For those who haven't seen it, Affleck decides he wants to get in on Jennifer Lopez's singing career. So he comes up with this rap song about Dunkin', and he walks in with just a disgusted Damon wanting no part of this, and Tom Brady on the DJ spinner over there and just dripped out in Dunkin' Donuts gear. I think he even had a Dunkin' Donuts chain on at one point. Absolutely hilarious. The song was even a bit catchy at one point. And then at the end, as they're walking out, Jennifer Lopez, his wife in real life, absolutely horrified. Everyone out the door, and then Tom's about to leave, and she's like, Tom, you can stay. Just so well done.
Yeah, that was a good one. I'm going to go with Kanye's Super Bowl commercial, who he paid like millions of dollars to get the Super Bowl commercial, but he didn't spend a dollar on the commercial. So it's basically just him filming himself talking about his album or something. Like, this guy does not care about what he puts out on TV. But apart from the Super Bowl, I was more focused on the halftime show.
I'm so glad you brought that up. And speaking of the liability himself, Mr. West, I wish he had been the performer.
Yeah, but they weren't gonna. They're never gonna put Kanye.
No,
West
he's not allowed near a microphone.
Performer.
No,
but Usher did a great job. He brought out Lil Jon, Ludacris, Alicia Keys, Will.i.am, all these big stars. It was a great show. I'm not even a Usher fan, but like, it was awesome.
Yeah, it was a huge one for me. That was one of my favorite songs growing up, and just seeing all the artists from back in the day come out there. I had actually seen Lil Jon live at Live Nightclub in Miami, and one of my favorite artists to see live. Just really brings the energy well, and
he's just yelling.
Exactly, just yelling. He's jumping up and down, and Ludacris is really good about getting in the camera into. Ludacris is always really good on stage, exactly. Yeah. Like, regardless of what you think about his music, he just really brings it and kind of gets into whatever persona the song requires. We're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come back with a little college basketball talk and a few other sports. Stay tuned.
Our talks about movies always start out with the best of intentions. Opinions are shared, debates develop. But then things get heated, words get said. Friendships are tested, disagreements break out. This is when the smackdown happens. Join us for our next epic grudge match, Sundays at 2 p.m., Cinema Smackdown, right here on CJLO 1690 AM.
Hansi, Ani, bonjour, hello. This is composer Andrew Balfour inviting you to experience Ispichiwin, a musical journey bridging cultures and perspectives. It is both a personal journey and evocative testament to the transformative power of music. This recording features Calgary's luminous voices with the incredible Jessica McMahon and Walter McDonald Whitebear on flutes. It is my hope that this album deepens our understanding of Indigenous storytelling. Ispichiwin is available now wherever you listen to music.
Welcome back to the Starting Rotation, starting our final segment here, Jacob Snyder, Dylan Adams. So Dylan, you and I have talked a lot about how into college basketball we've been getting, even more so than the NBA. So I actually wanted to weave a segment into the show here. Something I want to start off with, a team very close to your heart, and one we've been watching more than any of the other ones, the Miami Hurricanes. Very interesting team. It feels like they're extra talented. They have some young players that could potentially make a huge impact. But on the other end, none of the young players are seeing minutes. You're starting someone who's 6'8 at center. Seems to be a lot of hero ball late, deep threes, even though sometimes they are by your best player, Nigel Pack. Other times, lower tier players are taking clutch shots. Just want to get your take on their season so far.
Well, yeah, the U came into the season definitely with a lot of attention because they went on that huge Final Four run last year after going on an Elite Eight run, but they did lose two of their starters from that team. I don't know, man. I think I love Coach Jim Larrañaga. He's done so much for the program, but it might be time for him to go. Like, I don't understand the rotations they got out there on the court. We have a 6'10 center on the bench. He's a freshman. And we refuse to play him more than 5 minutes. Meanwhile, we're getting out-rebounded like crazy every game. Yes, our current center, Norchad Omir, he is a great rebounder, but he's 6'7". So how are you going to be a D1 team with a 6'7" center? And not only that, like you said, the young guys are barely getting any minutes. Instead, we're giving minutes to, like, think about number four, Bensley Joseph, recently. He was on the Final Four team last year, but he was coming off the bench. He's been awful, I'll be honest. He's a turnover machine. It seems like every time I'm watching these games, he's costing us the game. It's not only on him. It's like a combination of things, but like I don't understand the players they're putting out on the court.
I don't either, especially with how many good big men are in the game right now. You think about UNC, you think about Kansas, you think about Duke. All those guys have a 6'10", 7-footer who can go low post, catch the ball, and score. The one on North Carolina is amazing to watch. He can hook it with either hand every time, regardless of the defender against him. And if you slap a 6'8 guy on him, that's automatic. You're not even contesting his shot. He's already a great player, and not giving him the contest, you don't have a chance. I don't see the point in not giving this big center, big talented young kid, more minutes to maybe help.
And you would think after last year's run, they lost to UConn in the Final Four, the team who eventually won the championship, because of size. Like, UConn's guards were almost the same height as our center, and UConn this year still has like huge guys. You would think that our coaching staff would be like, hey, we got to get some big bodies out there. Like you just said, UNC, Amando Bacot, he's huge. Miami's coming into these games where their center is as tall as the power forward and some of the small forwards. Like, you're not going to win the game when that happens. You're not going to win the game when you're relying on five players and two of them to score, you know?
Speaking of UConn, though, any great teams outside of them, I'm so impressed by UConn's start. I just felt like UConn was in this pattern where it felt like they come out of nowhere once every 5, every 10 years with elite guard play like they did last year, win the tournament, and then fall right back off. But this UConn team has completely broken that streak. one of the hottest teams in the entire nation, the hottest team in the entire nation. Any other teams you feel like are on their level, or is it UConn, a big divide, and then everybody else?
I'm looking at the Big 12 teams. I think the Big 12 this year and the last couple of years has had the most competitive conference. I understand UConn is first right now, but they play in a less competitive, still a good conference in the Big East, but less competitive than the Big 12. I just wonder how they're going to do in the tournament when they come against adversity, when they go against adversity. Obviously, last year, they won every game by double digits. Kansas, even though they had a tough loss this week, I think they're playing really good. They're having trouble on the road, but they can still fix that up. Houston is up there. They only have three losses in the Big 12, but, you know, I don't know if I trust them either. Purdue, I know you have something against Purdue.
I have such issue with Purdue.
Purdue's good.
Tournament
but
chokers.
Yeah.
No faith in them whatsoever. I've watched them lose in the first round. You know, Purdue expected to make the finals. No show. Even their best player, Zach Edey, I understand he improves. It feels like every year. But the second the tournament starts, it feels like he's more worried about a beef with the opposing team than actually winning the game. I have absolutely zero faith in Purdue. But again, a Big Ten guy here, going to be some bias towards them. I've always rooted for Michigan. Something you touched on that kind of want to dive a tiny bit deeper into, that Kansas loss, that really alarmed me. I know you said just kind of wrote it off as a tough loss, and maybe that is. Maybe, you know, nothing comes from it. But they allowed one of Tech's better guards to shoot 12 for 12 in the game. They lost by nearly 20 points. Any concerns about their defense?
Yeah, it did seem a little concerning against Texas Tech. Texas Tech is, they're actually not even ranked right now, although they are ahead of Kansas in the Big 12 conference. This is why this Big 12 conference is so competitive. Kansas, it's still like, they still got some time to fix up their problems. I think they'll be fine come tournament time. It happens, you get blown out by a team in your conference. I wouldn't be too worried about it, but they gotta win their next game. Like, you can't be cold for this long. You know, they're 2-4, 2-5 on the road. Kansas, like, if you're gonna win the tournament, you can't have that happening.
Absolutely, you need to be more successful on the road, especially if later you're going up against a team like UConn and they have more fans traveling. I don't know how Kansas fans travel. I assume pretty well, but a hot UConn team in an area where they don't have a ton to do beyond root for the Huskies, their fans are going to travel to a neutral site. So you got to be able to win those big, tough matchups on the road. A team I'm probably way too high on right now, just want to get your take on quick, Syracuse. Absolutely love the way they play. Good defense, good guard play, three-point shooting. I really feel like this is going to be the team to maybe make a surprise run in the tourney.
Yeah, they could definitely shock some people. You saw it this week. They beat North Carolina. That's never easy. Syracuse, you know, if you let them get into the tournament, they're always dangerous. They could be a 10 seed, and they're always dangerous. I agree with that. Another team to look out for in the ACC, Virginia. They lost to Pitt this week, but their defense has been, like, absolutely incredible. They held a team was averaging 81 a game in Miami to 38 points. Like, I don't even know that's possible in D1. I think Virginia could be surprising in the tournament. But once again, like I told you, like, this Big 12 conference is unreal.
What do you make of UNC, though? Earlier on, it felt like that team was absolutely unbeatable. They ran away from Duke, vastly outplayed them, and then all of a sudden we're starting to see these upset losses creep up. Signs of weakness or just how the season goes, as you've been saying?
I think it's just how the season goes. Maybe a couple laps in concentration. Maybe at this point they just want to get into the tournament. You know, they've got a bunch of guys with experience. Baycott's going to be his second or maybe even third season. Like, these guys, maybe they got a little less motivated, you know, against Syracuse. Or maybe not less motivated, but, like, it happens. Like, this is college basketball. Like, these guys are fighting for careers. These guys are either fighting for career or fighting for their last season ever. Like, you're going to lose some tough games.
How much does a team like UNC, though, care about a 1 versus a 2 seed? in terms of resume? Like, end of the year, okay, they're doing seeds. Do you care if you're a one or a two?
No.
No.
In the tournament, I don't think so. Nobody has home court anyways, no,
but
you know.
In theory, you're getting the weaker matchup to improve your odds. But
for sure, but we've also seen, like, these 16 seeds beat the one teams now. I think, like, if I was a head coach, I'd be telling my team anybody in this tournament can win the whole tournament, you know?
See, that's why I'd asked you if there are any great teams outside of UConn. Now, UConn could easily go, cruise through, win the whole thing, no one would be shocked. But this really feels like a year where it's wide open again. Feels like beyond UConn, there's not any great teams, as we discussed. Could see any one of Carolina or Duke or Kansas with Hunter Dickinson, the Michigan transfer, potentially hoisting this, or maybe an unknown. Who knows? Maybe this is the year Syracuse goes on the crazy run and just tears through the tourney, or maybe Texas Tech slides in the back door. They've been there before. They've been deep in the tourney before. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe they make a surprise run.
Marquette also we haven't really been hearing about Marquette, but they've been in the top five most of the season. They're number four right now. They play in the Big East, same conference as UConn, so they'll be getting some big games before tournament time. They could go far as well. Like you said, it's wide open, man, because, like, even the UConn team, like I said, I don't trust any teams. Like, they could lose to anybody.
It really feels like it's one of those seasons. Real quick, we got about 4 minutes left here, Dylan. I know there are a few other sports you want to touch on. You want to start with a little Champions League here? You've been telling me those games have been great, eh?
Yes, Champions League is finally back after a couple-month hiatus. PSG, Man City, Real Madrid all got Ws this week. There's a report out this morning, as there has been every year for the last, like, 3 years, about Kylian Mbappe leaving Paris in the summer. This morning was Fabrizio. Fabrizio's like Woj for soccer. He released a statement this time for the first time, so now people are actually taking it seriously. He might be gone. Everybody's saying he'll go to Real Madrid.
But is this a ploy just to get more money from his current club, or
I don't know, because he's already making this guy's contract is unbelievable. He has like so much power within the club. I think it's just him wanting to. If you want to be the best player, you got to play in the best league with the best teams. Unfortunately, the French league is always seen as the league that's less strong, that's weaker than the English league, the Spanish league. I'm sure Mbappe, his idol as a kid, played in Real Madrid. He was a Real Madrid fan. He just wants to go there and play with the top club. That's my opinion. I don't mind.
Can't blame him for that.
Because if you, like, he's never gonna. I mean. I don't think he'll ever win with Paris. They don't have enough competition during the season to prepare them, and then they never go far in the Champions League because they don't have enough players. Even when they did have Messi, Neymar, and everything, like, it didn't even matter, you know.
They
didn't do anything with them.
I was going to ask you though, who do you see hoisting the trophy
this year at Champions League?
Yeah. I know it's still early, just got going, but any team really sticking out to you?
It's going to be hard to beat Manchester City. They got so much firepower with Haaland and De Bruyne and all that, but I think Real Madrid is going to come out on top this year. They've just got another team with a bunch of young talent. Thing about Vinicius, like, he's been balling. Like, I think they're going to make a run this year.
Now, going into the weekend, obviously no more NFL to watch, and as we've been telling you, get on college basketball. It's been so good. But outside of that, Dylan, what are we watching this weekend?
This weekend, Saturday, we got a huge, huge UFC event. We got Alexander Volkanovski going up for the Featherweight Championship of the World versus Ilya Topuria, who's been talking a lot of smack, saying he's going to end Volk and all that, completely disrespecting the champion. Got Robert Whittaker against Paulo Costa, two very entertaining fighters, co-main event. Then Ian Garry is finally fighting Jeff Neal. There's been a lot of controversy about Ian Garry and a lot of talk about his nutritionist being with his wife.
We can goodness.
Get into that on another
show. Yeah, that's next week.
And then Henry Cejudo, former champion, is fighting Marab. I can't even say his last name. Valshevili, who's an up-and-comer as well. Another one of these, like, guys that, you know, they fights like Khabib. Like, this is an immense card this weekend.
Also, could I interest you in a 3 p.m. tip Saturday, Marquette-UConn? We were just talking about how Marquette's going to have some big games coming up.
That is a massive, massive college game. That's number 4 versus number 1 in the country right now. Two Big East teams. Like, that is